Hi, and welcome to a response of the day for the 26th day of Adar Sheni. Today's response is actually going to be a follow-up to a response I think I did extremely briefly at the end of the shir for the 13th of Tishrei. The 13th of Tishrei, and not that you're required to remember this, but I made a note, or that I would have remembered this, but I made a note for myself, was a day when I did a potpourri, like a bunch of short tshuvot, short responsa of the Chatam Sofers. And at the very end, I did a response on a situation with a rabbi who might need to be removed from his job. So that was dated the 13th of Tishrei. And then in a later responsum from the, like 2.5 years later. So this is our response for the day, which is from Shur Chatam Sofer Chedek Hei Volume 5 in the Hashmatot, like the ones that are left out at the end, Simon Reish Zion, responsum 207, which is dated the 26th of Adar Sheni of Tuf Kuf Tzadi Zion of 1837, which is 2.5 years. Yeah, 2.5 years, just about 2.5 years after the first tshuva. He comes back to revisit the issue for reasons that we'll see. Let's first, however, make sure to pause to thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, and the OU for all of their assistance in making this shiurim available to you online. And then let me briefly summarize the first tshuva, which we also briefly summarized before, but just as a reminder. The question was about a certain rabbi who in our second tshuva, the one that is dated for today's date, the 26th of Adar Sheni, is attributed, the rabbi is named as a man named Yonatan Mishvarin. He was the rabbi of a place called Shvarin. He's a Yonatan, and he has got all sorts of issues. His community wants to remove him. They want to remove him for four reasons that we'll see, although the Chatam Sofer only refers to three. He clearly lists four. But this rabbi first claimed that the community didn't have the right to judge him because they weren't a court that he needed to attend. And then since he didn't need to attend it, they didn't have the right to listen to testimony about him because he wasn't there. So Chatam Sofer gets rid of that for reasons that we've seen. A reason one is that while it's true that you don't always have to give testimony in front of courts, if a court summons you for a reason having to do with your conduct, you have to go no matter what the court's status is. And the Chatam Sofer points out, you had great people in Israel. You had kings, you had, you know, heads of Sanhedrins. If a court thought they had to judge them, then they called them in and the person had to go. So that wasn't an issue. In addition, they weren't judging him. They were just accepting the testimony. We're going to then send it to great Torah scholars who were much greater than this man, and therefore there's no issue there. So that was issue number one that he raised, that I think will come up again in the tshuva that's for the 26th of Adar Sheni. Then there were four claims made against this rabbi. Claim number one is that he was halachically lax in his own practice. He ate without washing his hands beforehand. He didn't say Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. He would talk between putting on his tefillin shel yad, tefillin shel rosh, in ways that were not necessary. He would eat meat after hard cheese without waiting the right time. So, I don't want to say little stuff because nothing's little, but relatively minor infractions of halacha, but they were infractions of halacha that he did in front of other people without caring about it. That's an issue. Issue number two was that he also ruled for other people in ways that were too lenient. He ruled about trefot issues, about lungs of animals. He would say that they were kosher when almost everybody else was saying they were not kosher. He let all sorts of things like that we don't have to get into, but he would make a principle of the fact, he would, you know, be publicized the fact that he was a Mekel, right? That he was a guy, if you know, you don't have to go to those crazy rabbis, as it were, as he might have said, to get all their stringencies. I can give you leniencies, just come to me. So that means that he is helping lead many people astray, which is a more significant rabbinic violation, right? In his role as rabbi, he's doing it wrong. And then the last of these personal conduct ones is that he said out loud he doesn't believe in reward and punishment after death. That makes him, the Chatam Sofer said in his first tshuva, an apikoris and a min, so those are different standards of people who are leaving the religion, a min gamor. And then he says, and that would mean our understanding that's true of this person. Now this is a complicated issue that comes up repeatedly, because when we deal with people who have left religion, who have left observance, how do we react to them? And there are these standards in the Gemara that come up that people today sort of try to avoid admitting to. And one of those standards is if somebody's an apikoris or a min, so the Chatam Sofer says, "Asur klal likrov al petach pidei." We're not supposed to have any relationship with such a person, because they've left the religion so much. So how we handle that today is usually by saying that we think of them as a tinok shenishba. We don't think they really qualify as an apikoros or a min. Topic for another time. So those first three are modes of conduct that are mentioned. We'll get to how the Chatam Sofer dealt with them in a second, but the last one is going to end up being the most crucial, which is, and you don't need a testimony for this, but the man, this Rav Yonatan Shvarin, would put together gittin. He would write gittin for women. He did it twice for women in his city. Problem was, his city of Shvarin was not a place that had a tradition of how to write a get. There's a complicated technical issue to come up with writing a get, and this series, as I've been looking through for responsa to share with you, one of the things I've noticed is that Rav Pesach Frank, who was an important Torah scholar, many of his responsa that I find were on these kinds of technical issues. I think once or twice I took one that was fairly technical because I thought it was sort of so unfair to always leave him out, because he dealt with these kinds of issues that are important for halakhic purposes. It's just difficult, maybe for me, to communicate the significance of them. So writing a get, so in fact, writing a get is so technically complicated, the Noda Behuda actually said that you can't give a get in a place which doesn't have a tradition. Meaning, so the Chatam Sofer says, we can't follow that ruling, because people come to a new place, you have to get a get. I want you to go saw a responsum, a letter that Rav Nachum Rabinovich, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mahalei Adumim, he should live a long life, wrote to his Rebbe, Rav Yosef Elio Henkin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was a premier posik in America at the time, about how do you write a get in Charleston, South Carolina. About how to write a get in Charleston, South Carolina, because they didn't have a tradition about it, and they have to figure out all these technical issues, the name of the rivers, and how to write it. The Rebbe thought you shouldn't do it, because the says, we can't not do it, we have new places in life. But the first time you do it, you need to have a consultation. You can't just do it on your own. You need to consult. Even the greatest rabbis of every generation never would write a get in a new city without bringing together some friends and colleagues to first of all, to check with each other they agreed on how to do it, and then also that it become famous. This is now the tradition in this place of how we write it. And this guy didn't care about any of that stuff. He just decided he knew what he was doing. He wrote a get. And he is so unqualified to write a get that another local rabbi, the rabbi of Yarmouth, decided that those women should think and needed to think of themselves halachically as still married, because that get was so clearly invalid. So interestingly, in that response, and again, I'm doing this very briefly just because we're working our way to his responses in the second letter, that for the 26th of Adar Sheni, he said, though, that he thought that the personal conduct issues, as bad as they are, don't rise to the level of removing somebody from their position. We have a halakhic concept that when they av beitin, meaning a rabbi, an important rabbinic figure, or a rabbinic figure, violates the Torah, we do not put them into public banning, public communication. We say to him, listen, You really should be in need. You really should be under the ban. You just do it on your own. We won't pronounce it on you. Now, he doesn't talk about here the class is over, or other people. I haven't seen a lot of people talk about what do you do if the guy refuses to. So you'd have to move on to the next level, but that's a harder situation. So he does need tshuva, and there's a whole discussion on that, but that's not sufficient to remove him from his position as long as he does tshuva. If he doesn't do tshuva, class is over, doesn't get into that. Then the issue that he led other people astray in Horos about in teaching them and ruling for them about trefa issues, so that's also a problem as a rabbi. The idea that his belief system is not what it needs to be, that he's an apikoros, he's rejected important fundamental Jewish belief, that's a problem. And that is certainly enough of a problem since the Chatam Sofer, that he should be removed from his position, because that is rabbinic misconduct in his position. However, the challenge will be that the witnesses to that cannot be members of that town. Why can't they be members of that town? Because the members of that town can no longer use him as their rabbi, whether or not they can get rid of him. They can't use him as a rabbi because they know from their own experience that he's done X and Y and Z, and those X and Y and Z's make him unfit to be a rabbi. So unfit doesn't just mean they shouldn't have to keep him as a rabbi. It means they're not allowed to accept rulings on Torah issues from him. That's an important point that I don't think I stressed the last time I reviewed this, however briefly. The Chatam Sofer is saying when somebody puts themselves outside the pale of proper rabbinic leadership, it's not just that we don't have to pay, we don't want them in the job, it's that we're not allowed to follow their Torah because we can't trust that their Torah is valid Torah. And he's saying it as a broad-based thing, meaning if this guy just rejected reward and punishment after death, theoretically, that wouldn't affect him. And let's say he rejected reward and punishment after death, and he ruled for people way too leniently on whether animals are kosher or not. Okay, I want to ask him a Shabbos question. I want to ask him a question about lending money. I want to ask him a question about, you know, how to treat my children. Chazal Sofer is saying we don't trust any of his Torah because he's taken himself out of that group, and he's put himself into Syria in the group of people we have to just not trust and not respect in those ways. But to establish that as a halachic fact that can redound to his financial hurt, meaning losing a job, we're going to need testimony that is not from people who have a financial stake in their testimony. All the members of this town now can't list him in Torah, which means if he stays in his job, they're going to have to pay a man for a job that they can't accept him now. Unless they can prove that he's unacceptable, then they can't get rid of him. But to prove he's unacceptable, they can't give testimony because they're what's called nogin badavar. They have a financial stake in the outcome of the din, of the judgment. So unless they can find people from outside the community who know the actions of this man, then that would not be enough. And you'd have this bad situation where the members of this township would have to find another rabbi, the rabbi they could trust, while they might still have to pay this rabbi because they don't have a halakhically sufficient way to remove him from his position. Now, he does say that he thinks that the community's news about this guy is sufficient, that unless this man is willing to do tshuva, is willing to repent, he would lose his job. Meaning, it does establish it enough that to obligate him to tshuva. I think it would be because they don't have a financial stake in obligating him to do tshuva, I think, but he doesn't say. But then he says, the last saving grace is that no, but the gittin issue, the fact that he wrote these gittin, that doesn't need testimony that he wrote the gittin, because you have the gittin, it's well known, publicized, that he freed these women, he told these women they were not married anymore, they can marry other people. So that doesn't need testimony, it's just well known and famous. Kem ufor samim, ein tzarich rayis. Is that which is so well known doesn't need proof. Now, theoretically, that should have been true about other things that he'd done as well, meaning if he's just well known as a guy who denies issues of faith, then that would have seemed good enough as well. In any case, that which is well known is good enough, and therefore you can get rid of him. But then he says, not only can you get rid of him as your rabbi, but then he can't be a rabbi anywhere by virtue of these things, and therefore we should take from him hatarel ha-roch itru. You should take away his smicha, and he means take away the document of the smicha. He means like really defrock him, as it were, from the smicha that he used to have. So I think that's the first claim. The first tshuva was surprisingly willing to let him stay in place for various things, because unless you have actual halachic proof that somebody's done something, you're not able to hurt him financially. But in the end, you can, because he's done enough things in enough of a public way that we have reason to know it, and therefore he thinks you should strip him of any right of his to serve as a rabbi anywhere. Now, I didn't choose it for this reason, but this is obviously a response that goes, that has a lot of, unfortunately, has a lot of contemporary applications about when people do or don't realize that certain people no longer can be their rabbi because of by virtue of actions that they've taken, unless they do tshuva, and so that even if they do tshuva, they can no longer be a rabbi. Not our conversation, so we'll just move on to the next response. And this is the one that's dated the 26th of Adar Sheni, and it's from Tav Kuf Tzadi Zayin, so it's 2.5 years later, 1837. This Rav Yonatan Mishvarin had come to the Chatam Sofer to talk to him about it. I guess that Chatam Sofer's word was strong enough that he had lost his job, and he was having trouble finding jobs. And so he came to complain to the Chatam Sofer about how he'd been treated. And he raises three issues. The Chatam Sofer, whoever he's writing to, says the man raised Shlosha Divrei Barot. He raised issues that are so not issues, they demonstrated themselves how little understanding he has of the halakhic system. And I was pretty much silent about it because I made a rule for myself that I'm not getting involved in this issue anymore. Meaning, apparently, it would be not a small thing to get rid of a rabbi from community for his conduct. Chatam Sofer had gotten involved enough that apparently it was enough for him, and he said, I'm not answering these questions anymore. But now he's writing a letter to this guy, to this friend of his, and he wants to let him know what had happened. But he didn't quite answer this Yonatan Mishvarin. So he asked, this guy, Yonatan Mishvarin, had asked that he had raised this originally, and I skipped it in our brief review of the previous response. He had raised this before that he was unhappy. This Yonatan Mishvarin was unhappy that the witnesses were not made to take an oath. Right? You know, in American law, before you get up, you say, I do solemnly, do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, tell the truth. They didn't do anything like that. So he explained to him 2 years earlier, and that's part of why he wasn't answering him. He didn't want to go over all this stuff again and again, because the guy, you meet people who get stuck on an issue, and they keep raising the same issue, and you answer the issue for them, and they say, no, it's not that, and they raise it again. So he didn't want to raise it again, but he had pointed out to him that in halacha, that's not the way we work. We do not require witnesses to take an oath. In fact, the Chassam Sofer said, whenever you see a witness who halacha would require to take an oath, that's a sign that we don't trust him. But witnesses are supposed to be people who come into court. Before they give the testimony, the court says to them, be aware that false testimony is a very serious issue, and make sure you're telling us the truth, we're going to check you out and all of this. But then you don't take an oath. If there's anyone who needs an oath, that becomes a testimony that's seriously deficient just by virtue of the fact that an oath would be needed in order to allow us to believe the testimony. So this Yonatan Mishvarin, so he's a guy, he's a rabbi type, meaning he knows stuff. Points out that one of the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch and Koshen Mishnah, the Sma, the Sefer Mirat Einayim, says that there are situations where we will extract an oath from a witness, and the explanation that the Sma gave was, Kegon Sheroim Sheham Mikilim Biducheka, we see that people take lightly the idea of false testimony. I mean, we unfortunately suspect or believe that lots and lots of ordinary Jews don't think of false testimony as such a big deal. They not mikilim b'shvuat sheker, but they think of lying falsely as a big deal. This is an example of where it comes up, unfortunately, a lot. We have ordinary Jews who absorb a mistaken set of priorities from the world around them. So false testimony may be bad, but they're willing to do it. But lying under oath, that would be really, really bad, right? You certainly have people who would be willing to lie in a testimony situation, but not to perjure themselves. So you tell them it's perjury, then they'll be unwilling to, and they'll either not say anything or they'll tell the truth. So that's what this man raised with him. He said, it's a sma. What are you doing? Chassam Sofer himself. You don't know a sma. Sma says you can get an oath if you don't trust people. So the Chassam Sofer says the guy doesn't know what he's talking about, because what the sma meant was, if the court has come to realize that people are in enough, we have enough reason to suspect that people are going to testify falsely, they can start extracting oaths, but it has nothing to do with the litigant. His point was, this Yonatan Shvarin's point was, that he didn't want the courts listening to these people unless they extracted an oath, but the Chassam says, that's not your right, it's the court's right. And that's the only situation that was going on where you tracked an oath. And that would be true, by the way, he says, in financial cases. But here, they're giving testimony that you violated Shabbos, you did all these sorts of other things. So can you imagine if a defendant was allowed to say, I don't want to be punished for this. I don't want you to have the right. You don't have the right to punish me for this thing that they said that I did, these witnesses, until they take an oath. So that's ridiculous. So that's the Chassam's first answer was. But there is no right for a litigant, a defendant, to say these witnesses should not be believed until and unless they take an oath. Then the second issue that this man had raised with the Chassam Sofer was the Chassam Sofer had said that the people who believe the testimony of these witnesses, even if these witnesses are from the town, and therefore the Chassam Sofer had said they can't give testimony in court about this guy losing his job because they have a financial stake in it. So that would have seemed to be a ruling in this guy's favor. He still wasn't happy, because even when the Chassam Sofer said that, he had also said, the Chassam Sofer, that they can no longer listen to this man as their rabbi because Shavya Anavsha Chatecha Deisura, because they had turned him, by virtue of their believing the facts of the case, they had turned him into a person who was prohibited for them to believe and to accept the Torah from, because they think he's a guy who's left the religion enough that we can't trust him as a rabbi in any way, so forth and more. Now that's bad for this rabbi also, because then he doesn't have congregants who are going, he may get money, but he doesn't have congregants, and it's still an untenable circumstance for him. He was arguing with the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer got that issue wrong. That the only time the Shavya Anafshe Chatecha Deisura works, the only time that a person could say, well, it's already become, like, I have to think of it as prohibited, even though it's not established in court, this guy tries to say, that's be'edim ha'ne'em money. That's with valid witnesses. So the Chassam Sofer says, I don't know what he's talking about. It's completely wrong, because if it were valid witnesses, then we'd establish halachic facts. The whole idea of Shavi and Afshachi Chatecha Deisura, the whole idea that a person can create a prohibition for themselves that the courts cannot recognize, is when the person gives testimony in court, or other people give testimony in court, the court cannot accept, but that person has to accept. So there are times when a man might come into court and say, I believe my wife is X and Y and Z. Now his testimony won't be relevant because he's a party to the case, so the court can't act on it. But if he believes that, then he has to act on it, and he has no choice, and he'll have to act on it, even if it costs him financially. So that's the Chassam Sofer's point. This Yonatan Mishvarin tried to say, Shavya Nafshi only works with, like, valid testimony, valid witnesses. He says that That's completely wrong, because the whole concept of shavya anafshe is that a person comes to believe that something is prohibited to that person, that the outside world will not establish as halachic fact, but that that person needs to treat as halachic fact. So it is possibly true that if there are members of the community who come to... Now, there's an easy way, there's a clear way to say this, and then a way that the people might actually handle it. Let's suppose that the guy had not written those gittin, or and had agreed to do tshuva for everything else, whether or not he actually did the tshuva, but he agreed to do the tshuva, and therefore he's going to keep his job. You can easily imagine that some people in that community would say, oh my gosh, we're going to pay a whole second rabbi, and we're going to have to pay two salaries, we're going to have to go one rabbi for the actual Torah, and the other rabbi is going to get paid. You know what, I don't know that I believe those people so fully that I'm willing to do that. Now, it might be that they really stop believing those people, or it might be that it's just inconvenient to believe those people, and therefore they say, I'm not going to believe them anymore. But they'll have that right, because if they can say, and they're willing to stand by their claim, that they no longer believe those witnesses who are from the town, then for those people, it will no longer be shavya nafshi. The people who saw it themselves, they have no way out, because they saw it themselves, so that's a maharik, but basically, the cousins of everything, they have no way out. So then another issue that this man had raised with him was that the Chasam Sofer said that he had to go in front of the court that summoned him, because he has to go through a court that summons him. So this guy had said, no, it's not his obligation to do so before them. And then the Chasam Sofer says, but you know what? This guy later went before a court of three rabbis that were, of rabbis from three important kehilot that the important people of Pesht put together, and he good, and he they accepted testimony, and there was a whole court case going on, but fundamentally came out to the same conclusions as the previous court, that he refused to attend. So I didn't do anything wrong, because he ended up going to basically the same court and got basically the same result. So that's no claim that he has against me. Then this guy claimed that he had been mistreated because one of the judges in that case was later on arrested by the secular authorities. And so this guy said, so that shows that guy wasn't a good judge, and I was judged by him, so that was unfair. So the Chasam Sofer said, first of all, I was not the person who picked the judges in that situation. So there's no reason to complain to me about it. It was the Gong of Sento who was handling this. But more important than that, he says, the fact that a man gets arrested by the non-Jewish authorities sometimes means they've done a crime, but we have a tradition of people, great rabbis, who are arrested for no good reason. The Maharam Rutenberg was arrested, he says, in the Tower of Inchbarg, which to me is interesting because this happens in the late 1200s, but Chasam Sofer knows the story. It's a reminder that knowledge of Jewish history is not something that didn't happen to great Torah scholars. They all knew the basic history of the Jewish people, because these were important things that happened, at least in the world of Torah. Rabbi Akiva was arrested and killed in his life. We don't think they were like properly caught. So being caught is an issue, or being arrested is an issue, but it's not always an issue, always a proof that this rabbi should not have served as a judge on that court case, and therefore you haven't proven anything about that either. And then, I don't know why I came out here, but on that issue of that court, whether he should have had to go appear in front of the court, Chasam Sofer points out that he appeared before a certain court voluntarily, saw a whole case through to completion, which means that he has now accepted the idea that this is a court that he is comfortable judging in front of. And then when that case finished, they said, you know what, let's have testimony about that other issue, and he ran away. Now, he ran away because he thought that by not being there, that would stop them from being able to accept testimony about his situation, and therefore he'd get out of it. But he stood before them, so that shows that he has no problem with them being the judges, and therefore that whole claim goes away. And then he points out that some of the friends of this guy said, you know what, and this happens too, and so it's got very contemporary overtones as well. Friends of this guy said that it's not true that all these things happen. It's not true that he's not valid to be a rabbi, that I knew that all of these claims that they're making, the Chasam Sofer is now one by one getting rid of and saying are not valid claims. He's saying they all claiming about me that I know that these claims aren't valid. And I was doing Elash Asiti Lemegdar Milta. I did it I thought this is like a special time in Jewish history and there's a special dangers facing the Jewish people. And therefore, I made, extra rules that aren't really on the books in order to stop people from going any further. This didn't justify the reaction that I gave it, but I did it. I, Chasam Sofer, did it for these reasons. That's what the people claim. So the Chasam Sofer says, that's not true. It's a lie. Well, how do I know it's a lie? Or how can I show you that it's a lie? Because the rule is, and halacha actually, there are cases where a court is allowed to do extra actions, to punish people extra stringently in ways that they shouldn't be required to, that wouldn't, right? So one example is a court, sometimes the Gemara reports that a court put to death a man who rode a horse on Shabbat. Now, riding a horse on Shabbat is not a capital crime. They put him to death anyway, not because it was a capital crime. They put him to death because it was a time when people's Shmirat Shabbat, people's observance of Shabbat, was weakening. Another example of that was that they gave lashes to somebody who I think had relations with his wife or fiance like in a publicish kind of a place, which again is not good to do. It's a violation of modesty and appropriate discretion, but it's not a crime in the Torah in any way. So, but the Chazal wanted it to be understood that this is not acceptable behavior for Jews, and therefore they gave lashes to the guy to make that point. So the Chassam Sofer says, so it happens to be the next situation, nobody claimed that it was illegal, that they were doing it for legal purposes. They all said they were doing it in order to be Megdir Milta, in order to shore up the defenses of observance, shore up the public recognition of the importance and the need to follow the Torah. And the only people who complain about that are people who would say that you don't need to do this. You don't need to protect the public from themselves. You don't need to train the public to keep the Torah better, which is an interesting claim because I hear this often today, right? If other people want to violate the Torah, what's it your business? But that's not the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition is the communities and the nation and their leaders of the nation are supposed to be doing their best and making all possible efforts to stop people from sinning. And it's not a person's individual right to choose to sin and things like that. We're supposed to, and that was the way the Ramban quotes a Sifrei, that's the way we read the verse, Asher lo yakim et divrei Torah hazot. When the Jews are standing on Har Gerizim and Har Eval, and the Levim say, Arur Asher lo yakim et divrei Torah hazot, one of the meanings of not establishing this Torah is watching people violate the Torah and not bothering to try to do anything about it, not bothering to try to make offense against it, not bother to try to stop people from violating it. So that's what's going on. So the only people who can complain about it, so even if they were right, that's why they did it, that would be wrong for them to complain about, because who's complaining about it? You don't complain about these things. And not only that, some of these people are no longer living, and if they just looked after what they did and really investigated what they were doing, what they were thinking, they would have seen that these were valid and good, important actions, and that they were necessary. So Rakhazim is saying, basically, they were necessary really on a full halakhic level. But even if you want to claim they were done as an extra legal practice to try to demonstrate a fact about observance, about the proper way to treat people in halakha, and the proper way to act, that's also important. And the fact that you complain about it itself shows you to be in a bad situation, because it's the job of Chacham. And this is obviously a hard question, because I could easily imagine finding myself a situation where there are people doing something Ligdor Pirtzah, that in their minds they are protecting proper observance, and I would think they'd gone too far. So these friends of this guy could have, might not deserve all the wrath that the Chatzam Sofer is presenting here, because if they're protesting that the Chatzam Sofer and colleagues of his, some who are no longer alive, were doing something excessive to protect observance, then that doesn't seem to me such a, it's a bad claim because they're not of the stature to be the ones to complain about that. But that's not quite what the Chatzam Sofer is responding to. In any case, he thinks that, so, and then another claim that they could make is that, yeah, there's such a thing as making these kind of protective rules, but these people don't have the standing to do it. They're not sufficiently experts in Jewish law. They should be the ones doing it. They're not sufficiently gedolim. He's not answering that at all. So then he says, and this guy left, and I don't know where he went, so we didn't talk a lot, and so basically it's all over for me. I'm not writing about this anymore. But for the 26th of Adashini, Tov Kuf Tzadivav, the Chatzam Sofer revisited this issue and showed us some of the complications of getting rid of or dealing with somebody who is in the process of leaving the religion but knows a lot enough to, grasp technicalities and to grasp to the claim that he should still be allowed to be a rabbi, even though he's clearly made himself unfit to be a rabbi. And the Chatzam Sofer deals with it one by one calmly and addressing all the formalities of halakha while also making clear where our values lie. My name is Gideon Rusty, and this has been a responsive day for the 26th of Adar Sheni. But thank you to Rabbi Jacob Robbins, David Hachhauser, and the OU, and thank you for listening.